Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 360. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in thisshowissogay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a wonderful episode for you this week. Let me introduce our guest. Chadwick Moore is editor-at-large for Out Magazine and The Advocate, and a contributing writer to Playboy and The New York Times. Chadwick covers subcultures, crime, offbeat stories, and the LGBT community. His work has taken him, among so many different places, to the gay underbelly of Moscow in the aftermath of their anti-LGBT propaganda law, to the streets of Queens, where undocumented Latina transgender sex workers struggle for survival, to a ranch in Montana to explore Native American two-spirit identity, to most recently Orlando, Florida, in the aftermath of the massacre there. You can check out what he put together. It's in Out Magazine. It is also on the cover of The Advocate Magazine right this very second. We're going to talk all about Orlando, but first, Chadwick, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you, Ken. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
It's been 2 years since you've been on the show. We have a lot of ground to cover.
Yes, we do. Yeah, I guess it has been that long. Time flies.
Before we get to the specific stories, let our listeners know, how does your writer life work? Are you mostly pitching the stories? Do you get told, hey, this is what you're covering? What's that balance like?
I'd say it's about 80% at least my own ideas and pitching, and then the rest would be assignments that are sort of handed down to me, which usually tend to be the most fun stories because they're things that I would never usually think of covering, and so it ends up being more of a challenge and sometimes more interesting that way.
Yeah. Well, let's jump right into it, because as we mentioned on last week's episode, we talked a little bit about Orlando, but we kind of danced around the edges. You didn't just dance around the edge. You and some other writers there at Out Magazine, you went straight down to Orlando to start collecting stories. Is that how that came about?
That's right. Yeah. I woke up Sunday morning. I woke up sort of late, and I had a text message from our editor-in-chief that said, can you go to Orlando this afternoon? And I had no idea what was going on. You know, I was like, I thought, you know, it's like gay days at Disney World. Like, what is this? And then I turn on the TV and I see the news, the horrible news. And I got on a plane, went straight to the airport. And my colleague, Michael Lambert, who I was there reporting with, happens to be in Birmingham, Alabama. And he got a car and drove down and met me later that night.
Can we pull back the curtain on what happens in your head? So before you even got there, you're booking a flight, you're going to go down there. How do you start framing in your head how you're going to approach this work?
I knew that, I do human stories and I do features. And since they'd asked me to go down, I knew that that's what they were immediately looking for. So I knew that I had to get there and just start talking to people in the community, how they're feeling, getting their reactions. I knew it was going to be very focused on the human angle of this tragedy and getting to know the people who were lost.
How do you find people to talk to? I would imagine that the press frenzy down there was almost indescribable. How do you get access?
It was, you're right. It was an absolute press frenzy. Working for the gay media really was a benefit because people, I felt, really did want to talk to us. They knew that we understood, you know, perhaps better than some of the mainstream medias of what the community is like, what's going on. So essentially it was really showing up and just talking to people. I mean, I went to plenty of gay bars while I was there. That was probably the easiest way. And Orlando's an extremely tight-knit community. So everyone you spoke to had a story, and everyone knew someone who passed away or was actually at the club themselves that night or was supposed to go there. You know, you kept getting these sort of interweaving narratives of you'd hear a name that someone knew, and then that name would come up with someone else you're speaking to. And you really did get the impression that it was like a family, even before this tragedy happened.
Yeah. What narrative threads emerged for you? You're collecting all these stories. What did you see time and time again?
There were a lot of near misses, a lot of people who they're supposed to go that night to Pulse and they didn't, or they had left 15 minutes before the shooter came in. There was a guy, a go-go boy I spoke with, his name is Javi, and his box that he dances on is right next to the entrance. And he was supposed to work that night, but he picked up a bartending shift somewhere else. And he was talking about his favorite bartender there, Juan, who was shot in the leg, and the customer Juan was shot. And then later on, speaking to this young man, Brett, who lost his boyfriend that night, and he was ducked under the bar, ducked under the well, the bar, while hiding, and he was with Juan. He was helping Juan bandage up his leg. So you get like these people who all the lives were just very intertwined.
Yeah. You wrote this in the piece, in one of the many pieces. After an hour of speeches and prayers, the bell from a nearby Methodist church begins to toll 49 times, once for each victim. Each toll resonates longer than the last in the hot, thick air. Framed between the sterile edifices of downtown Orlando, sherbet-colored thunderheads loom on the horizon. Later, people remark that the bell tolls seem to go on forever. When they thought, surely this must be the last one, they weren't even halfway there. There had to have been just so many emotions present as you're navigating through this story.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was from the official vigil on Monday night in downtown Orlando, which was an extremely emotional and powerful event. So, lots of tears, so much grief, a lot of confusion. You know, people weren't really thinking about the politics of it. They weren't, thinking, is this ISIS or all this other chatter that's going on in the in a lot of the media. It was just sort of a complete outpouring of grief and also of solidarity coming together.
Yeah. Now, you're a professional writer, but you're also a human being with emotions. I'm not saying the two are mutually exclusive. I'm sure they go hand in hand. But you are...
Sometimes.
You sometimes that they are mutually exclusive, or sometimes you're human. We'll question that later. But you are somewhere behind the pen, a gay man who's also experiencing things on that human level. And I know that this isn't just confined to this particular story, but how do you do the push and pull as you're pulling this all together, as you're piecing this all together with your own emotions that are going on in your head and what you're also trying to get out there?
I really embrace being emotionally involved in this and being empathetic. And a lot of reporters, and even in the gay press, they're just sort of straight news reporters. So they do have that skill of being able to distance themselves from the content and just get the job done, file the story. But that's not the kind of writer I am. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I do often get, I have a lot of empathy for the subjects that I'm writing about. And I was I embraced it. I had a lot of emotions, and it was very difficult being there. But I think that also in situations like this, I think helps the story. If you are really empathizing with the people you're speaking with and with the community and grieving alongside them.
So much of the criticism after all the media coverage has been put out there and continues to be are just other news outlets, other media outlets in general that really have not covered this very well. I would imagine that you saw some of your colleagues down there approaching this in maybe not the best way.
Yeah, there was a lot of, I don't know how to say. I think that it was interesting because a lot of the broadcast media, they were doing what they were doing, what they always do, and they'll do the exact same thing in a week when we have another mass shooting. And they sort of show up and they unload. But for the gay community, it was such a visceral event and such a visceral experience. And I think also in the gay press, our coverage is going to be completely different because of that, For a lot of the sort of listening to some of the questions that reporters were asking people on the scene, and it was just sort of like, oh my God, they felt so dumb to me, And I'm like, but then again, that's I'm gay, so I have a better insight into the community and the sort of things that people want to talk about. So I think that a lot of the people I spoke to who were affected by this weren't super keen on how they're treated by the press or what the press was doing. I mean, not that there was anything untoward going on, but it just seemed, this sort of general idea of like, you guys don't get it, but then we go like Anderson Cooper and Don Lemon and they're gay and they work for the mainstream broadcast media. And I think that they were also sort of feeling the grieving alongside the people in Orlando.
I watched a piece this morning, some clip that I somehow missed from last week, of some gay Fox News contributor who was being really critical of Anderson Cooper's getting emotional as he read the names, as if, look, you just cannot be presenting these stories in an emotional way and still be a professional. And it struck me that, by the way, you know, in addition to feeling like, wow, you really are not a good gay person for putting this content out there, that, that those two things, again, are just not mutually exclusive, that one really can inform the other.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that this is such a special circumstance that, you know, I think it's great that Anderson let his emotions show.
What has the response to your coverage been like? I know Aunt Scotty loved it.
Yes, Aunt Scotty. Hi, Aunt Scotty. She did love it on Facebook. Aunt Scotty is a hero for the gays in my family.
Nice.
From her son, my cousin's also gay, and she sort of changed the dialogue. But enough about Aunt Scotty. So this watch, you know, it's been the support from friends and family obviously has been great. You know, coverage is, yeah, I'm very proud of what Michael and I accomplished when we were in Orlando. I think that we really, you know, worked very hard and really met some amazing people, and they're so grateful that they share their stories with us.
Incredible. Incredible work. All right. Well, so many other stories that you have been covering to talk about. Let's just take this next one in order. We won't jump to the ending of the story. This is going to be a hard one to take in order. So let's just stick with the facts at the start, and then we'll get to some of the other pieces of the story. Somewhere in your life at some point, someone said, hey, can you do this story on Nick Jonas? Is that how this started?
Yes. It was our editor-in-chief, Aaron, just said, but, you know, would you like to do the cover for the June issue with Profile Nick Jonas? And I said, yeah, of course, why not, you know? That was another one of those examples of an assignment that I'm sort of like, yeah, it's something I would never usually think of to do, and yeah, this will be fun. Let's make this a challenge.
Okay. Can I just ask on a very base level, is it more exciting when you're told you get to do a cover story? It strikes me that would be more exciting.
I don't know. No, I guess not. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's always nice to have the cover. Yeah. But, you know,
I'm not saying you don't take it seriously or put in the work. I just think there's a part that's a little exciting. Like, all right, I wrote the cover story.
Yeah, I guess it's exciting.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I'm just happy every time I see my name in print. So that's,
glad we talked you down from that one, the false modesty. There's no false modesty on our show. All right, so Aaron Hicklin, who was on this show years, I would say like 7 years ago, so he says to you, all right, we're going to do the story on Nick Jonas. Now, Nick Jonas, an ever-present personality, it seems, quite ubiquitous coverage of him in the community. How do we approach doing this particular story?
Well, you know, the biggest critique of him in our community is that he's gay baiting, right?
Right.
So that's obviously an issue to address. You know, I mean, the thing that I found most interesting, because I don't typically follow celebrity. I don't typically follow the kind of music Nick sings. But I was really fascinated that he's been essentially in the spotlight since he's a child. So the whole child star thing. So I really wanted to get into growing up in the spotlight. I really wanted to get into his family. I really wanted to get into the human side and not just promote the album. The gay baiting stuff is sort of, you know, like I had my suspicions, but I wasn't really, you know, all that mad about it like some people were. And, you know, when I met him, I thought he was a really lovely, really nice young man. Yeah. And you know, I asked him about these accusations of gay baiting, and he said, you know, I think it's really sad that you'll feel that way. And I'm sure he's been asked that a lot. So,
yeah, well, I got more. I got more questions on this whole Jonas thing. But for our listeners who maybe don't know what gay baiting is, how would you describe gay baiting?
Gay baiting is a term that has come into use, I would say, in the last few years of essentially, I guess, straight people kind of courting the gay audience for their own benefit. So whether that's like playing lots of gay roles or sort of, you know, pretending that they might be gay or bisexual to get, you know, people all hot and bothered. You know, maybe it's that, like that old adage, like Sex in the City, first the gays and the girls in the world. So maybe it's this sort of PR, people suspect it's this PR thing to get, you know, essentially to raise someone's profile.
Okay. Now I will tell you, let's just take this to the next step. Why do you think, Chadwick Moore, if you do, that might be a problem? Because I've talked about this with other members of the LGBT community, and some folks would say, well, it wouldn't be a problem if the gay community didn't buy into it.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not certain that it's a problem, you know, because it does, it's good for equality, it's good for acceptance, it's good, you know, if these people are, you know, if they are pandering to the gay community, well, if the gay people are buying it, they're buying what they're selling, so, and, you know, they're perhaps, you know, someone like Nick Jonas, who speaks out very much in support of gay people and plays some gay roles on television, you know, he's probably got these, like, young teenage fans who, they see him supporting gay community, that's great, you know, maybe they feel more, better about who they are or better about supporting the community. So if it's a problem or not, I mean, I don't know, who's to say, right?
Right.
It's people I would say it's a problem because, you know, they're just using us and they're not one of us. And I think that's probably the biggest complaint.
Okay. So you meet up with Nick Jonas, you play mini golf, which isn't a metaphor. You guys actually played mini golf.
That's right. We actually played mini golf.
Mm-hmm. Do you wake up in the morning and think, I played mini golf with Nick Jonas, and that's not a metaphor?
Every day of my life.
By the way, I have to ask, did you guys keep score?
We started to, and then we just, like, fell to the wayside. But I think we tied.
Okay.
I won or we tied. Mm-hmm. It was pretty even. It was fairly matched.
Okay, so you do this story, you put it out there, and then there's a vigil in New York City for the victims of Orlando and tons and tons of folks at the vigil, and one of the people who speaks at the vigil is Nick Jonas, and this is while, if I'm getting this correct, and stop me if I'm wrong, you are still in Orlando at the time.
Correct.
Okay, mm-hmm. And then writer Chadwick Moore takes to Facebook to pen an open letter to Nick Jonas. How we doing?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I did.
How would we go about summarizing that letter?
Well, that letter, essentially I heard about Nick speaking. I had a little bit of downtime in Orlando and I just was so, I was very upset. And so I just started, you know, I knew I want to write this out. And I contacted my colleagues out and I said, I'm thinking about putting this on Facebook. Like, are you okay with that? And they said, you know, that's your Facebook, do whatever you want. So and I'm like, you know, and this is not by any way, anything I said, it's not, you know, coming from Out Magazine or its parent company. It's just me. So anyway, I was, you know, I was very upset. And I thought it was just such poor taste for him to do that. I thought it was such poor judgment. I've calmed down a little bit now, but at the time, I just found it really, it kind of made me sick. And I essentially, you know, I think that if he hadn't been, you know, he was in New York City promoting his album. He was already on a press tour, and then he shows up and does this. So people are like, what about Lady Gaga speaking in Los Angeles? And, I heard that her speaking there, she sort of showed up with, like, no makeup, and she was very sort of raw and real. And also, like, that's L.A. It wasn't, like, outside of the Stonewall, which is, like, you know, the closest thing we have to Mecca. So I wrote a very sort of visceral, angry, and hurt open letter to Nick. And I sent it to his people and said, you know what, like I'm actually open to dialogue. I just want you know that I did this and like I would like to talk and they haven't responded. But yeah, that's, I mean, I'm sure you read the letter. It can get kind of nasty.
I did. I actually didn't find it nasty. I found it to be raw and I found it to be a real reaction. This is my favorite piece. It's towards the start. And you're again referring to Nick Jonas appearing at this vigil in New York City. You wrote this quote, I don't know which heartless moron on Team Jonas came up with that idea. And if it was your brainchild, which moron on Team Jonas didn't stop you? I heard that you said on TV to Andy Cohen that Governor Cuomo invited you. You should have declined. You should have said, it is not my place because Nick, it isn't your place. One of the reasons that I'm even highlighting this letter, I found it to be extraordinarily compelling, but what you're also doing in my mind was really articulating that we have this defined community and we have this point in time where we're coming together and expressing a shared identity and for other people to, not just metaphorically, but literally take their microphone, that's problematic.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt, and I think many, if not most people, feel that way, although I have gotten some really nasty flack on that Facebook post, but yeah, I think that's it. That's sort of what it comes down to, and people are saying, you know, like, the Monday Night Vigil was sort of worthless. It was, you know, a bunch of politicians promoting themselves, and the actual, like, really heartfelt one happened spontaneously on Sunday night outside of the Stonewall. So people were saying that, but still, I agree with you. It's taking the microphone. It's sort of like you know, it just was such poor judgment in my decision, and it hurts. You know, this is a moment in our history, and now this is a part of the record of it. You know, this young straight man in town promoting his album, standing up and addressing us. Yeah, I think it's painful, and it kind of sucks. But
there's no way to divorce and this is my thoughts as well, like there's just no way to divorce the fact that you're on a promotional tour. Wait, I'm not for these couple minutes at the microphone. Well, no, you kind of still are on your promotional tour. There's no way to pause that. And sure, he's not saying at the mic, buy my album, but that's what he said right before and right after, you know, in other appearances.
Right.
So
yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm thrilled that you wrote that. I was like, I definitely had a moment of reading that, and I turned to my partner and said, ooh, like that was my response. It was definitely like, this guy went there. I did have a moment, I will tell you, that I thought, oh, he's going to get in trouble for this. I was worried for you for a minute.
I wasn't worried because everything was so raw. And you know what, like, yeah, you know, it's sort of like, I'm happy that I have this very strong opinion about this and this voice. And I think that only makes us look good, you know, in terms of the people I work for, to have this sort of diversity and opinion. But yeah, I wasn't really worried about getting into trouble.
All right.
You know,
I'm not saying we wouldn't have you back on the show, but the bio of Chadwick Moore, unemployed writer, that it's just not as compelling for our listeners. It's just not.
Oh, please don't ever say that again.
Sorry.
Use those words together.
Sorry, I meant to say Chadwick Moore, who currently has the cover story on Out Magazine. But to have these two things, I will just say, let me just end the Nick Jonas piece with this part, the fact that you're not just someone who is going off on Nick Jonas on Facebook. You're someone who currently has profiled him for a cover story for a major LGBT publication. And the confluence of both of those things is quite striking, Chadwick.
Why do you say that? Why do you think that?
I think because you're someone who's engaged with him on a number of different levels, so you actually have some knowledge. And I liked the fact that you actually referred to that and said, look, I just did this piece on you, and here's how I feel about that. It was just, again, it's this idea of really being very transparent and very raw and speaking from the heart. It did quite a bit for me reading that on Facebook.
Yeah, you know, like I said, like, I don't, like, you know, I question the judgment, I attack the judgment, and I'm essentially just, I'm celebrating our community in that.
Yeah.
And I'm not name calling Nick or anything. And like I said, like, I thought he was a really sweet, very, very nice, very kind young man. But I was just so angry at that decision and that judgment. So, you know, like, do I regret, you know, that we have him on the cover? No, I don't, actually. And I think that the interesting thing about putting him on the cover is at first there, you know, people were sort of saying, this was sort of a long-running issue with putting straight people on the cover of gay magazines,
right?
Whether we should do this or not. And I was sort of thought, even if we had, like, Cher on the cover, no one would question it. So I'm like, I think it's actually a really great idea to put, like, this young straight guy, this pop singer, on the cover, because, you know, if it had been a woman, nobody would think twice. So let's explore this, you know? So yeah, like I said, you know, I don't regret the story. I just regret that he made that decision.
There you go. Again, listeners, we are here with the very employed Chadwick Moore, editor-at-large for Out and The Advocate. Let's talk about a couple other pieces that I have to tell you. The one that really ripped me to shreds and that I've shared with so many people, and I know it was on a couple different lists for folks to check out, the piece that you wrote entitled The Good Wife. Tell everybody about that piece, The Good Wife.
That was a story that ran in Out. I believe it was the September issue last year. That was a very powerful experience. It was sort of about, I'd wanted to do, the story behind the story is I'd wanted to do a story about people in mixed orientation marriages, or what's called moms, which would be, say, a gay man married to a straight woman, and they're totally out and open about it, and they can do their own thing. So I found this woman online who self-publishes all these books, and they sort of have these, like, kind of very outrageous titles, like The Bride and the Doom, and, like, you know, Straight Wives, Shattered Lives, and Bonnie Kay is her name, and emailed her, and then the more I got talking to her, she sort of is this, she counsels women who have been, mostly women, but there are some men, who whose husbands came out as gay later in life. And these women are sort of just devastated. And, you know, they might be in their, like, 30s, 40s, 50s, or 60s, and she has this sort of network of like thousands of people who she sends emails out to, and she has meetups a couple times a year. And then there are a few women like her in the country who do this. So I met up with a couple of them. And the interesting thing about this is the gay men are always, they tend to be very celebrated when they come out later right. in life. And like, you know, yeah, you're living your true self. You're being who you are. And the wives are sort of brushed aside. And they're also kind of viewed as being naive or by conservative people, it might be viewed as like, well, you turned him gay. This is your fault. And they're never celebrated. And that's sort of what people don't have a lot of empathy for them. And that's sort of what Bonnie and a lot of these other women were doing. And so I just thought that was such an interesting thing that nobody really thinks about. So I just sort of profiled her and a few others about these lives and about what happens to the spouses when someone comes out as gay. And, you know, they often feel so, you know, like their lives are over and that the last maybe 40 years of their marriage was a lie and all these other issues. Those women are doing great work, and they're really a pleasure to meet.
I was so struck by the different treatment that you just referred to. You wrote in that piece, quote, "But the revelation that a spouse is gay is so incredibly traumatic for many women that they are often in counseling for years or decades to come. Society tends to view them as either naive or deficient, while their husbands are lauded for having the courage to be their authentic selves." It was so striking to put that out there with your turn of phrase and these interviews. It really, that was one of those pieces that really made me pause. It was incredibly well done.
Thank you very much.
I was also seeing that it was on, and again, you and I talked about this a few years ago, some lists of long form articles that people should check out. I just bristle a little a bit at the idea of a long form article because it points to this trend of, oh gosh, if it's more than, you know, a page or two, it's considered long form. So you really have to dedicate some time to it, when at one point, was that the standard for journalism?
Yeah, I think you're right. There'll be like, you know, those sites like best long reads of the week, and it's like 1,000 words. Yeah.
How do you navigate that? Because I still write for the Huffington Post, and they say, oh, you know, 500 words. And I'm thinking, I basically say a point. I say like three sentences in 500 words. I don't get to anything. But I don't want to write for people who only have 6 minutes.
Yeah. I feel the same way. I mean, you know, there's something to, That has its place, but I'm sort of thankful that quote unquote long form still is around and still people still want it. You know, I don't really understand the 500 word max thing, because if you're writing something that's compelling and keeps the eyes moving, then you're not going to notice that it's, you know, been 2,000 words or right. what have you. Yeah.
There you go. All right, one more piece to talk about. You wrote a piece All called right. "Trans in the Military: How the Face of Service is Changing." Holy crap, was that a great piece.
Thank you. That was interesting to sort of see the statistic that trans people are, see if I can word this correctly, trans people are twice as likely than the general population to serve in the armed forces. So there's twice as many trans people in the U.S. military than the general population. That, I thought, was so fascinating.
Yeah. And was that one of those pieces where getting access to folks was a challenge, or were you able to get people on your radar?
It was after I sort of got, you know, like one email address, everyone was sort of coming at me like, yeah, I'll talk to you. They all really wanted to share their stories. And that was lovely. So I went to Washington, D.C. and just like, you know, a stone's throw from the Pentagon, this woman who had served was having a birthday party. And so there was like 45 trans people from various wings of the military at this little bar, like next to the Pentagon. It was a riot, and everyone really wanted to share their stories. You know, they want to get it out there, and it's fantastic that we're at a place in history right now where trans people are so eager to tell about their stories.
what should we, the reader, walk away with on that one? Because it strikes me there's still so much work to do, by the way, including reminding people that Don't Ask, Don't Tell did not address all people serving openly in the military.
Right. And the Department of Defense sort of said that they're no longer going to discharge people who are openly trans. That before that was the law, you would just get kicked out of the military. The ban on trans people serving openly was supposed to be lifted in May, and I'm not sure if it happened. I haven't followed up yet on that. But the thing that arrived, you know, military people, they love the military. It's their family, and you know, you get so many people who, and the trans women that I spoke to who really have nothing but positive things to say about being in the military. But the issues arise that when this ban is lifted, we still don't know what's bathroom use going to look like, what's locker room is going to look like, what's uniform going to look like, you know, what's the standards of hair and makeup for trans people. You know, we don't know if there's going to be an uptick in violence. We don't know any of these things yet. So the sort of initial, like, okay, trans people can serve openly seems more symbolic, and it's a great move. But really nobody knows how open people are going to be allowed to be.
Yeah, it's a great piece. Everybody needs to go check out that piece, Trans in the Military, How the Face of Service is Changing. I will say, while I have you on the air, I tend to use you to tell me about cool things that are happening in New York City that we should know about. You're like our Brooklyn correspondent. You always know things.
Senior Brooklyn correspondent.
You are. You can put, that's a resume builder right there. So I'm just putting that out there. Any cool things that you have encountered that we should know about going on there?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, I barely leave my apartment except to get on an airplane to go somewhere. So the kids are doing all right. I'll say that.
Okay.
You know, we talked about, last time I was on the air, we talked about Bushwick a lot. That's still, you know, where all the cool kids are going. So much drag in Brooklyn. It's fantastic. There's, you know, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a drag queen. And they're doing like so many fun creative things. And, you know, every night of the week you can go to a bar with drag queens in Brooklyn. It's great. Yeah, otherwise, you know, I'll have to do some more field research on that and get back to you.
You're going to have to get back to us. Yes, my best friend owns a bar in Brooklyn, and she was not intending it to be a bar that was populated by drag queens, but I guess it's quite the hot spot there in Brooklyn, and it's a great...
which one is it?
One Last Shag?
Oh, yeah. That's in Bed-Stuy.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be a great place. I haven't been yet.
Good times. Good times. There's her shout-out. What story are you working on next? What should we be looking out for from you?
Well, I am looking into, I won't say for which publication, the murder of gay bloggers and publishers by ISIS in Bangladesh. So
that is
something on the horizon that I'm looking into.
Are you hopping on a plane for that?
We'll see.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have different lives, Chadwick Moore. You really are. That's incredible. Gosh, I mean, it's similar to the Russia piece of you definitely put yourself in these situations where you're getting at the story, but then I'm also sitting here all the way in Cleveland as your gay Jewish mother, a little bit worried for you. Me and Aunt Scotty, we want you to be safe.
I appreciate that. You are the gay Jewish mother I've always wanted.
There you go. I get that a lot. I get that a lot. Listeners, this is what you guys need to do. Stroll on over to ChadwickMoore.com. There are two O's in Moore. You must put them both in. ChadwickMoore.com. He is extraordinarily employed. You can check out different pieces that he has written there. You can go on over to Out.com and read, type his name in there, and you'll read all of these great pieces. You've been to a Ren Fair. Am I getting that one right?
I did. Oh, I love a Ren Fair. Yeah.
I was an NYU medieval studies major. I have never been to a Ren Fair, and I don't understand how that's possible.
Oh, my God. Well, we'll go together next time. Maybe you should come here for the one this summer, and we'll just go together.
I love it. I'm doing it. Chadwick Moore, your turn of phrase, your pen is making a difference. Please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much, Ken, and same to you.
New York City, 1988, standing in the Chelsea rain with a small suitcase. I used to walk invisible, and the only time I felt recognized is when I saw myself reflect.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode to get to all of the latest LGBTQ news. I do have a new post up on the Huffington Post. You can search for it by title. It's called Why This Gay Jewish Democrat is No Longer Volunteering at the Republican National Convention, which should maybe not be surprising to people. And certainly that's some of the responses that I have received from people who have not actually read the piece. But I was signed up to volunteer for the Republican National Convention. I'm telling you, all roads seem to lead through Cleveland these days. Certainly the Cavaliers, it was just incredible to be here. I'm not exactly the biggest sports fan. My sports focus has always been tennis and pretty much exclusively tennis. I am a tennis fanatic, but not really with other sports. I do enjoy basketball. I like the sports where people score. I'm not a huge fan of sitting through scoreless games. So baseball and football, when somehow 0-0 can be considered a good game, yeah, that's not for me. I like when people score. Soccer? No. I like when people score. So tennis, basketball, even a little bit of golf. So the Cleveland Cavaliers winning, I wish you could all have been here for this. It was like 1.3 million people showed up for the parade. It was very, very exciting stuff. And then this summer, again, all roads leading through Cleveland, the Republican National Convention right here in Cleveland, Ohio. And I signed up to volunteer. I was so excited to volunteer. This lady on the radio made a pitch and she said, it's not about party politics. I am not a Republican. I will admit that here. I don't think that's something you have to admit, but I am not a Republican. But she appealed to geographic pride, and I was all about geographic pride. She said that it was about showcasing Cleveland, not about party politics. And I'm thinking, you know what? I'm all about showcasing Cleveland. It's a really cool place to live. I just taught a class last semester all about the relationship between individuals and their city. It was called Urban Community Life. And one of the signs that is a sure indicator that people really love where they live is that they feel that they can make a difference here. And that's one of the things I hear time and time again about Cleveland is people feel like they can actually make a difference here. So I certainly feel that way. So yeah, I signed up. And then you can check out the piece. Again, the title is Why This Gay Jewish Democrat is No Longer Volunteering at the Republican National Convention. I just got scared. I really have seen the violence at these various different Trump-related events, and I think focusing all of that energy on one particular place is going to be really scary. And there is that potential for violence, and it freaked me out. And so if you check out the piece, you will read about my journey from volunteering to getting scared to where I ended up, and I won't ruin the ending for you. You can check that out on the Huffington Post, or you can go to thisshowissogay.com and click on the little Huffington Post icon, the H right there on the right, and you can check out all the pieces I've ever done for them. Enjoy that. And according to The Advocate, the Republican National Convention just got a lot scarier. The white supremacists involved in a melee in Sacramento over this past weekend, they plan to provide security at next month's convention, promising to protect Donald Trump supporters from leftist thugs. That's a quote, leftist thugs. Matt Parrott, a spokesman for the Traditionalist Workers Party, said this quote, we're essentially just going to show up and make sure that the Donald Trump supporters are defended from the leftist thugs. So yeah, I think maybe I have good reason to be a little bit nervous here in Cleveland. Let's get to the news out there, though. It's not just about me. It's not just about Cleveland. There are other things happening. Two transgender candidates have won their congressional primaries, making them the first openly trans people to be nominated to Congress by a major political party. Misty Snow and Misty Plowright, those are two different people just with the same first name, they both won their respective Democratic primary races in Utah and Colorado on June 28th. Utah Democrats voted for Misty Snow as their party's nominee for Senate. Snow will face off against conservative Senator Mike Lee in the conservative state of Utah in November. Misty Snow, a 30-year-old, currently works as a cashier at a grocery store, defeated conservative Democrat Jonathan Swinton 59.5% to 40.5% in the returns. She said this quote, a lot of people have told me whether I win or lose, I'm already making a difference just by running. Love that. Meanwhile, Misty Plowright, the other Misty, was nominated by Democrats to the House in Colorado's conservative 5th Congressional District, which has never been held by a Democrat. She will challenge Republican Representative Doug Lamborn. This Misty, Misty Plowright, is a 33-year-old IT worker who defeated Donald Martinez by 58 to 42%. She said she is an anti-politician. That's a quote. She is an anti-politician. So yes, an anti-politician. I love that. Misty Snow said this about Utah, quote, "There are some that claim that Utah is not ready for a candidate like me, but I strongly disagree. Utah is not only ready, but in desperate need of a senator exactly like me. We cannot wait for others to give us equality. We have to claim equality for ourselves." So we will certainly be keeping our eye on both of those Misties. I love that. Oh, great story here. Great story. An 8-year-old trans girl raised enough funds to open a transgender house across the street from the Westboro Baptist Church. On Sunday, this past Sunday, Planting Peace painted their new transgender house in the colors of the trans flag next to the rainbow-painted Equality House they've been running since 2013. The two houses are opposite the notoriously anti-LGBT hate group Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas. The Westboro Baptist Church, if you don't know, they're known for picketing the funerals of servicemen, as well as being a little too obsessed with the bedroom habits of LGBT people. This is according to Pink News. The new house, which is a welcome haven for all trans people, was made possible with the help of an 8-year-old trans girl, Avery Jackson. Though the Equality House is painted in the colors of the trans flag for a week every year, Avery also wanted a special place for trans individuals where they could go all year long. This 8-year-old said this, quote, "I loved the Rainbow Equality House when it was painted like the transgender flag. I felt so happy and proud to be transgender. I wish people weren't afraid of transgender people. I'm not a monster. I'm not scary. I just want to be treated like every other human." End quote. I love this. When a developer, Martin Dunn, heard about the fundraiser, he offered Avery and Planting Peace $70,000 to build the house of their dreams. Explaining why he donated to the cause, father of three, Mr. Dunn, said that, quote, "If I had a kid that was transgender, I would want a place that would celebrate them and accept them. That's just not available in this country, and it should be. The idea that it would be across from a hate group was also really appealing." There you go. It's a great picture. This is radio, so I can't show you the picture, but go look up the picture. It's the rainbow house next to the pink and blue and white trans house. It's so wonderful. It's a great image. A great image. More from some anti-gay folks. These are always fun to cover. Less than 300 people turned up to a Washington, D.C. rally opposing same-sex marriage as the hardline anti-gay lobby slowly dies out. The National Organization for Marriage held a rally in Washington, D.C. this past weekend to protest the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage. As the main opposition lobby to equal marriage in the U.S., the National Organization of Marriage's rallies before the Supreme Court ruling had drawn crowds of thousands. They used to draw thousands, but now it was less than 250 people attending. The president of the National Organization for Marriage said, "You know what? It's because people are out there grieving about marriage." He said this in a message sent to supporters. He claimed the rally was, quote, "a huge success." He claimed that double the independent headcount and sharing tightly cropped photos to disguise the lack of a large crowd. He said that's what's happened. He said this, quote, "I'm writing with great news. The 2016 March for Marriage this past weekend in Washington was a tremendous success. We had about 400 people join us at the rally and march, and they were an enthusiastic and inspiring group of supporters. Many families came together to march. One family I spoke with drove down from Philadelphia. Another family came from Long Island. We had people join us from as far away as Utah and California. I met people from throughout the Northeast and the South. One supporter even came from Sri Lanka to be with us. In short, it was a great event. We expected that the crowd would be smaller than past marches because people are still grieving from the U.S. Supreme Court's illegitimate decision redefining marriage. And he has vowed to keep going. He has vowed that this is going to be his life's work. That's what's so incredible. He wants to do this every year. On the one hand, I applaud his commitment. On the other hand, it's really, really sad. We have marriage equality now. Let it go. Don't look back at the end of your life and say, oh, this is what I spent it on. But you know what? Who am I to say? I am not one to say, this is how you spend your life. That's not what we do. We should not be out there trying to convince anyone of anything, particularly Republicans, because it doesn't work. I have thrown myself into it. Guys, I have gotten obsessed. I'm obsessed with a couple Twitter folks. There's this one guy, Chad Felix Green. He wrote a piece for the Huffington Post called "I'm a Gay Conservative, It's Time You Met Me," something like that. And it was seen a couple thousand times. And this is a guy that just spews horridness. And I keep engaging with him, and I don't know why. I have to stop doing it because I'm not going to change his mind. He is certainly just going to keep belittling and demeaning other people, saying there's no such thing as the LGBT community. He says these horrible things, and he's this gay conservative, and it's horrible. And I need to let it go. And I think, guys, I think it might just be hubris. I think it's my hubris. I think that there is this part of me that thinks, oh, I'm going to keep engaging with him. I'm going to highlight this one thing, and he's going to turn around and say, you know what? Totally right, Ken. We have a community. We should stick together, and that's not what happened. So it is not for me to say anything to the president of the National Organization of Marriage. We have to just keep using our own voices. Don't use them to shout down someone else. I don't know that that works. Do it to be disruptive. I'm fine with that. I just get nervous if you guys are out there thinking, I am going to change this person's mind. The only way that we change our minds is by living our truth. It's by being out and open if it is safe for you to do so. I am not one of these people who says come out no matter what, because I think that if you are financially dependent on other people and your coming out would jeopardize your livelihood, your ability to live your life, you have to consider that carefully. You really do. Again, those folks who are out there saying, come out no matter what, I do think that's irresponsible. That's not what I think. But if you are in a position to be out, if you are in a position to be open about your life, that does change minds. It is so much more difficult to be homophobic when you are saying it to someone else. The problem is that, you know, in some of these folks' lives, they don't actually know someone who's gay. And so that makes it more difficult. Although not Chad Felix Green, he is gay. And he's still, I must say, kind of horrible. He puts horrible things out there. I shouldn't even be promoting him, but there it is. You know, another thing that's not helping us is when people make false reports about hate crimes. And so right this second, at the time of this recording, the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office has charged YouTuber Calum McSwiggin with one misdemeanor count of filing a false report of a criminal offense. McSwiggin is scheduled to be arraigned this week at the Airport Courthouse in Los Angeles, and if convicted, he will face a maximum sentence of 364 days in jail. McSwiggin spoke out about allegations from the Sheriff's Department that he injured himself after being arrested. Oh boy, he was arrested for vandalizing a car this week. The gay YouTuber published a photo online this week claiming in the caption that he was attacked by three men outside of a gay club. However, that story came into question after the police released a statement saying they witnessed McSwiggin beating himself in the face with a payphone receiver in a holding cell. Police also released a booking photo that showed McSwiggin had no injuries on his face when he was arrested earlier that night. McSwiggin, who is 26 years old, maintained his innocence in a Facebook post. I read the whole thing. It was published this week saying, quote, just because there were no visible marks on my face does not mean I was not attacked. I only hurt myself to get out of the jail cell. McSwiggin described feeling heartbroken about the events, and these have been the worst few days of my life. That's a quote from him. He addressed the charge that his story about being attacked outside a gay club was fabricated. He said this, quote, many people are trying to discredit my story, but this is the full and entire truth. He claimed that a man had flirted with him, lured him to a dark parking lot, then punched him in the mouth. He said this, quote, I blacked out quickly after this, but remember being kicked in the body multiple times, I believe by all three men. When he came to, McSwiggin said the car he believed to be the attacker's was still there, so he vandalized it in revenge. He concluded by saying this, being accused of being a liar and being called a disgrace to the LGBT plus community, a community I've dedicated my life to, is more painful than any hate crime could ever be. You can check out his full post on Facebook. Look, this guy is innocent until proven guilty. That's the way our system works. And this is a lose-lose. This is an absolute lose-lose situation. Either he was the victim of a hate crime, right, which is terrible, or he made all this up, which is terrible. So it is a complete lose-lose. People are seizing this as an opportunity to attack him, but then there's also people saying, hey, let's wait until all the facts come out, but it's a depressing story. No matter which way this story ends up, we do not win. We as a community do not win. Another place that's really difficult to win right now, as always, is in Texas. The Republican Attorney General in Texas says a local school's transgender inclusive policy violates state law, and he proposes an idea that may itself run afoul of federal protections for trans students. Responding to a query from noted transphobic Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who I will tell you, I was at an event this past weekend, and I had the great opportunity to spend some time with the former mayor of Houston, Anise Parker, and I asked her about Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. She did not hold back. Turns out, yeah, according to all the stories, it's really true. He really, not a good guy. Not a good guy. Anyway, it was a query from noted transphobic Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick there in Texas. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton this week issued a non-binding opinion that declares a modest trans-inclusive policy at the Fort Worth Independent School District a violation of the law. So Paxton proposes his own solution for faculty to out trans students to their parents. The policy adopted April 19th by the school's district superintendent affirms that transgender students throughout the district should be granted access to the restrooms and locker rooms that correspond with their gender identity. It also requires that schools respond to any requests by students for access to a private single-stall restroom or multi-stall restroom when no other students are present. But the equal bathroom access isn't what the state's top lawman took issue with. The opinion issued this week pointedly avoids any discussion of federal non-discrimination protections that already exist for trans students. Instead, this Texas Attorney General, his criticism of the policy focuses on a provision that instructs teachers and faculty to confer with a transgender student before discussing that student's trans status with their parents or legal guardian. He wrote this, quote, "Far from creating a partnership between parents, educators, and administrators regarding their children's education, the guidelines relegate parents to a subordinate status, receiving information only on a need-to-know basis. Furthermore, the provision requiring school personnel to work closely with the student to determine to what extent, if any, a parent will be involved in the student's transitioning suggests that employees could, pursuant to these restrictions, encourage some children to withhold information from a parent. Such action is both against state law and grounds for discipline under the Education Code." Okay, so that's what he put out there. But according to the American Civil Liberties Union, it's illegal for school staff to discuss a student's sexual orientation or gender identity with other faculty. It's a violation of privacy and a dangerous one. You actually can't do this. The National Association for School Psychologists likewise advises that educators should be cautious about publicizing a student's trans identity or even a student's exploration of their gender identity. The association's professional ethical guidelines instruct school psychologists to, quote, not share information about the sexual orientation, gender identity, or transgender status of a student, including minors, parent, or school employees, with anyone without that individual's permission. It's not good. It's not good to be putting this out there, Texas Attorney General. Teachers, if you're listening, don't do this. Don't do this. Talk to the student first. Don't just out them to their parents. That is not your role. Your role is to protect the students. Now, parents can be unbelievable allies, and they can really help you out in these situations. But first, check with the student. Oh boy, so much going on in Texas. And Anise Parker, and I'm holding her to this, when I met her on Sunday, I said, hey, I would love to have you on the radio show. She said, let's get me on the radio show. So I will get her on the radio show. A couple other stories out there. We don't have too much time left to talk about them. Caitlyn Jenner. Caitlyn Jenner apparently praised Donald Trump's policies on women's rights and LGBT equality in a new interview with People magazine. She said this, quote, "Trump seems to be very much for women. He seems very much behind the LGBT community because of what happened in North Carolina with the bathroom issue. He backed the LGBT community." It's not exactly what he did. Anyway, Jenner then clarified that when it comes to Trump, his platform is not without flaws. She said this, quote, "In Trump's case, there's a lot more unknowns. With Hillary, you pretty much know what you're going to get with the LGBT community," end quote. Unsurprisingly, she has experienced quite a lot of backlash in the LGBT community for these comments. I would direct you to Noah Michelson, the editor of the Huffington Post Queer Voices section. He's got a really funny response about it. It involves maybe taking her to a place to deprogram her. I'm not endorsing that. I'm just saying it's slightly amusing. And finally, a story from Pink News, and you should check this out. According to a report published this week, LGBT adults are more likely to smoke and drink heavily compared to heterosexuals, published in the JAMA Internal Medicine Journal by researchers at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine and University of Minnesota School of Public Health. The National Health Interview Survey collated responses from 68,000 U.S. adults. LGBT adults report substantially higher rates of severe psychological distress, heavy drinking, heavy smoking, and impaired physical health than heterosexuals. The results support earlier findings that members of the LGBT community are disproportionately affected by mental health problems, which may be related to stigma, prejudice, and discrimination. This is all to say there is so much more work to do, folks. There is so much more work to do. And by the way, these studies are enabled by researchers actually asking about sexual orientation and gender identity. It really helps out. We did a show years ago just about research with folks from Fenway Health there in Boston who are doing great research. And it's not the most sexy topic, research, but collecting data on sexual orientation and gender identity, it makes a huge, huge difference. So if you're out there doing research, add that question to your demographics. You can find out a lot of good stuff, and it helps us make changes, appropriate changes to our healthcare system. And that, my friends, is really all the time we have for this week's episode. Next week, our wonderful friend Tucky Williams, who's doing such great work in the entertainment industry, she will be on next week's show. We haven't talked to her in 5 years. She hasn't been on the show, so we're going to catch up with her. You guys, you know what to do. Get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters and all of those allies out there. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Baby, take a walk in toilet and be my hero, play the part. I'm falling down hard from salvation. Come to take this channel home. Though my party dress is torn, I still walk and talk and cry and crawl. I've got no one on my own. Well, I'm just a rumble doll. And now some girls are just born lucky. Yeah, they're lucky, that's for sure. In my soul I never felt that clean. Though I know my heart is pure. Sometimes I feel like I know too much, and sometimes I feel like I don't know nothing at all. I can still be soft to the touch. Well, I am just a rumble.